As the U.S. Supreme Court continues to stay in the headlines, a new one-hour documentary explores the life and legacy of Thurgood Marshall. The film draws on archival recordings, personal photographs, and exclusive interviews to offer a portrait of a man who helped reshape our nation's democracy even before he became the first Black justice on the Supreme Court. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the life and legacy of Thurgood Marshall is Will Haygood. He's the author of Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. He's also a scholar in residence at Miami University, and he's featured in the documentary. Thanks so much for being with us, Will.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Many of us know Thurgood Marshall as this towering figure, but he had a fairly humble start in life.
Yes, he did. He was born in Baltimore. His parents were not that well off. Mother, a school teacher. His father had not a very highfalutin job. The family had two sons, and they struggled to send both of their sons to college. They sent young Thurgood to Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. He was a smart, savvy student, and he had an interest in the law, and he got accepted to Howard Law School, and he started to rise from there. Several professors saw that. He had a very, very, very active mind. He cared about human rights and civil rights, and he was on his way.
You mentioned Howard Law School, a very prestigious law school, of course. The dean, Charles Hamilton Houston, was so influential for Thurgood Marshall. Can you tell us a bit about the dean?
Yes, he was a very, very astute man who looked around the country, knew that America was infected by virulent racism, saw a way to start attacking some of that through the legal process. He came up with an idea to travel through the South shortly after Thurgood Marshall finished law school and in the early 30s. And Thurgood and Charles Hamilton Houston got in a car and traveled through several southern states, talking to Black folk and white folk, but mostly Black folk, about hardships. And they also talked to local lawyers. Both were already dreaming of ways to attack systemic racism in this country then. And they were kind of like mentor student. And Marshall, of course, watched Charles Hamilton Houston very closely on this trip. He learned a lot, and he committed himself to the law. And it wasn't long after that that he came up with this brilliant idea, Thurgood Marshall, to form the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And they went at it whole scale, sort of to form a small army to force courts in the laws of the land to live up to the promise of the U.S. Constitution.
What is striking to me is the importance of law in determining the condition of the Negro. Just realize, he was effectively enslaved by a law which declared him a chattel of his master. He was emancipated by law, and then disfranchised and segregated by law. And finally, he's beginning to win equality by law.
That was a tall mountain to climb, and what I sometimes tell students is that, yes, Marshall showed up in a lot of courtrooms, of course, and he was facing the best of the best. He was facing white lawyers who had trained at Harvard and Yale and Stanford. And these were men, and they were almost always men, who considered themselves experts in upholding segregation. And so it wasn't like Marshall was winning these cases up against fly-by-night lawyers. He was going up against the best of the best, and he was winning. He was breaking down the American system of apartheid all throughout the 1940s, really, when he has some significant victories.
You know, most of us think of Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court, but this documentary mostly focuses on his career before joining the court. How influential was he before joining the Supreme Court?
Enormously so. Marshall looked around the country, east, west, north, and south, and he said to himself, well, we have a voting rights problem over here. So I'm going to go down to Texas and I'm going to fight a major voting rights case. And that became Smith v. Allwright. He knocked down the all-white Democratic primary. That was a huge victory. You know, my fear in life right now is that people don't understand the mountains that Thurgood Marshall and his team had to climb to win. America set up a very sophisticated system of segregation. It was so sophisticated that Nazis in Germany looked at that system, looked at America's system and said, wow, that's a pretty ingenious system. You tell blacks where they can use the restroom. You tell blacks where they can shop and where they can't shop. You tell blacks what time they can go to movie theaters and when and on what days. You keep blacks out of corporate jobs for decades. That's a very multi-layered, sophisticated system. And Marshall looked at the school system in Topeka, Kansas. And then he found a few other cases, Washington, D.C., Richmond, Virginia, South Carolina, and he merged those cases together. And that became the Supreme Court case, Brown v. Board of Education out of Topeka, Kansas. Now, that case was so psychologically important. It said that separate but equal is immoral. It made the country look in the mirror, and Marshall was able to convince an all-white Supreme Court that he was right, that what America had been doing with its laws allowing segregation was not only immoral, but illegal. And Marshall kept doing this, voting rights, housing, law enforcement. He was one of those lawyers, Lucy, who worked under a threat of death all the time. Most lawyers that he ran into had nice, cushy jobs in these white law firms, and they never were threatened with death just for trying to do their job. Thurgood Marshall was. I remember when I was doing research for my book, Showdown, I went down to Florida, and there was a man who served as Thurgood Marshall's chaperone. This man was white, and he met Thurgood Marshall at the airport. And he said to Thurgood, he said, listen, Thurgood, you know I love you, and my family loves you. And if anything happens to you down here, the people who I care about will be highly upset. So I'm going to have to ask you to lie down in the back of my station wagon, and I'm going to cover you with a blanket until we get to the hotel. Because if you're seen, visibly seen, somebody could stalk you at night and shoot you. Now, to have someone tell you that, and to know that the next day or the day after you have to go to court and you have to be alert and savvy standing on your feet during that court session because the weight of Black America is on you. How do you do that? I mean, he was like a Superman to face death threats and then to go into court and win. It is astonishing.
So he became known as Mr. Civil Rights. Black people would ride into town to watch him in court. What did it mean to say Thurgood is coming?
It meant everything. It meant that a Black mother or father could tell their son, their daughter, their niece, their nephew that it is possible to become a successful and committed attorney of the law. Even when that law is arrayed against you, it is possible to overcome that. there were a lot of white heroes who helped Thurgood Marshall, who worked with the NAACP. And so he knew how to bring them into his tent. But it meant that America needed to find a path to integration. There were studies done in the 30s and the 40s in the military that showed when black soldiers and white soldiers worked together that, for the most part, everybody did better and felt better. But of course, our first racially fought integrated war wasn't until the Vietnam War. And so it still took a long time for America to get used to integration. Were it not for Thurgood Marshall, it would have certainly taken even much longer.
You were talking about the danger that Thurgood Marshall faced in Florida and the man you interviewed for your book. At one point, he was almost lynched.
The mob got me one night, and they were taking me down to the river where all of the white people were waiting to do a little bit of lynching.
So how did he make it out of that situation?
He was so lucky, and that also became an earmark of Thurgood Marshall's life. He was very fortunate to have survived that infamous incident at that Tennessee River. He was very lucky because some of his friends who had driven ahead into the nearby town were waiting on Marshall. And when he didn't show up, they were able to circle back and they found him. And the situation resolved itself. But he had many close calls. The Florida situation, too, stands out to me. Marshall had at one time visited Harry and Harriet Moore. They were both voting rights activists, and they belonged to the NAACP. And they were trying to register blacks to vote. On Christmas Eve, 1952, I think it was, I write about all this in the book. Harry and Harriet Moore went to sleep in their bed. In the middle of the night, a pipe bomb that was planted by the KKK goes off in their house. Harry Moore dies. Harriet Moore lived another week, and then she died. A couple months earlier, before this bombing, Thurgood Marshall had slept in that very house. So it could have easily been him who was in that house that night. And so fortune was on his side so often.
He had so many friends and admirers who, you know, he refers to in the documentary as invisible heroes of the civil rights movement. What did they risk in protecting him and helping him, you know, get around these towns that he visited?
Mm-hmm. Well, if they were white, they were told that they would be beaten or lynched too, if possible. There was one very shrewd move that Thurgood Marshall made in his life. Before he went south, or before he went on some of his long trips, he had a friend inside the FBI in Washington, D.C. Marshall would make it a habit to go visit that friend and say, "Hey, I just wanted you to know that I'm on my way to Tupelo, Mississippi, or I'm on my way to Atlanta, Georgia, or I'm on my way to Stuart, Florida." And that FBI agent would look out for Thurgood Marshall. He would call to make sure that Marshall showed up at his hotel. He would call to make sure that the ticket agent at the local airport sold Thurgood Marshall his ticket. There was one incident where Marshall needed to get out of Florida. There was yet another death threat against him, and the ticket agent wouldn't sell him his ticket. The ticket agent kept saying that the flight that you want to get on, Mr. Marshall, is sold out. Now, we'll never know if the ticket agent had gotten word from somebody in town to sell Thurgood Marshall his ticket or what. We'll never know that. But we do know this. The FBI agent called the airport and threatened them and said, "If Mr. Marshall is not on that next plane, we're going to shut the airport down." Now, you often hear that the FBI in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s was no friend of the civil rights movement. But Marshall had made a friend inside of the FBI offices, and that friend looked out for Marshall. He knew that when he traveled into these foreign territories in his own country, that he needed help. He needed somebody to watch his back.
Brown versus Board of Education is probably his best known case, but the documentary says that case was actually funded on the back of another case, the Groveland case. Can you tell us about that one?
Well, the Groveland case involved a sheriff who shot several unarmed blacks down in Florida. And there's a very fine book written about that case, written by my friend Gilbert King, that's called The Groveland Boys. But there were so many cases that Marshall fought. You'd think that we had, at the time, 500 Thurgood Marshalls running around the country. But we didn't. And there are other lawyers, men and women, white and black, as I said, who was working in Marshall's orbit. Marshall was very smart at looking into, say, St. Louis or Harlem and finding the most talented civil rights lawyers and assigning them to a certain case. He was a genius at that. And I think, you know, at the top of the program, you had talked about Charles Hamilton Houston. I think Marshall learned that from Houston. Just as Houston chose Thurgood Marshall went about finding other talented lawyers, young lawyers, and he put them to work. And it worked. It worked. They all worked hard. They all wanted the country to do what it was supposed to do. Everybody was supposed to have an opportunity at life, liberty, and justice. If you were black, you didn't. And they had to change that.
Then, of course, there's the Brown versus Board of Education case.
In a unanimous decision, the 9 Supreme Court justices ruled racial segregation in publicly supported schools to be unconstitutional.
Did Thurgood Marshall think the fight was won at that point?
No. He famously said that he knew that there were going to be Southern states that would object to it. Some didn't, but some did. In the state of Virginia, closed down its schools rather than obey the law. I think we can fairly say that segregation endured in many cities, north and south, and throughout the Midwest for years and years. And we still have vestiges of that today. But what the Brown decision did, it rolled out a feeling that separate was not equal. It put into the lexicon of the nation that the word equal must mean something. Thurgood Marshall did it through the court system, and then you had Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and Rosa Parks and all of the other great civil rights leaders doing it on the ground. Marshall did it through the laws. And I think that was very important.
Ultimately, he argued 32 cases before the Supreme Court, and he won 29 of them. What do you think made him so successful?
He wouldn't quit. He was a very smart lawyer. He studied. He knew the law up and down and back. He was never caught off guard. And he believed in the country. He believed that the country could turn around. Just think. It took faith for him to risk his life and to subconsciously say, well, if I win this appeal, if I win this court case, maybe I can impress the nation because laws will have been put on the books to tell the country that you can't keep blacks out of country clubs or out of law schools or out of jobs if they're qualified. He had to have faith that he could do that. And he did.
Do you think he ever imagined he'd be appointed to the Supreme Court himself?
No, I don't. I think that was just a highlight, you know, the big highlight of his life. I don't think he ever saw that coming. I think he was extremely gratified when it happened. He knew he was qualified for the job, and he knew President Lyndon Johnson's heart was in the right place. And there we had it. Thurgood Marshall, 1967, appointed to the Supreme Court. It was a rough battle. It took a long time that summer to get him on the court, but it finally worked out.
What do you think his most important role was on the court?
To constantly advocate for justice and fairness. Mind you, he was representative of the man who brought down the American system of apartheid. He brought it down. He crippled it. And so he was the guy who did it.
We have certainly not reached the point I would have hoped we could reach. We have had setbacks even. But what we are proud of in the United States is that we are making progress. We've got movement toward it.
Considering what Thurgood Marshall just said there, how do you think he would view the times we live in now?
Very tough, very challenging times. There have been attacks against DEI every day of the week. There has been rollbacks by the people in the White House right now. And I think there is a fear that the country is losing ground when it comes to equality.
Well, I have been talking with Will Haygood, an author and scholar in residence at Miami University. Thank you so much for your time today, Will.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The new documentary, Becoming Thurgood, America's Social Architect, premieres at 10 o'clock tonight on CET, PBS.org, and the PBS app. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.